is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome, my friends. It is your weekly one-stop shop for the strange and the unusual, and I am your guide into the dark realm of the Mohorovic discontinuity. That's right, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grillion Report. As always, broadcasting from the bunker, deep, deep within the earth below the Appalachian Mountains. Caleb Hanks joining me in studio. Caleb, how are we this evening? And, of course, as always, Tyler Pittman, our producer.
Greetings.
Thank you. Thank you, Tyler. Oh, it's going to be a fantastic show tonight. We're going to be looking at conspiracies. We're going to be looking at William Cooper. And then we're also, during the second hour, going to be talking with probably one of the most enigmatic guests that you're going to hear in a very long time. He's well-known and well-renowned for his theories about the age of the Sphinx, and then, of course, also theories about ancient civilizations that may have existed before our own. His name is Dr. Robert Schock, and we'll be discussing his book, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And let me tell you, while we're discussing this with Dr. Schock, we're also going to be getting a little into the potential that this sort of thing could affect us in the future. That's right. Electromagnetic coronal discharges from the sun that could literally wrap out, or completely at very least disengage for a time, the electrical grid. It's a very, very frightening concept. I spoke with Dr. Schock very briefly about this earlier today, and of course, you know, while we'll be focusing on the ancient aspects of this and how this could potentially have affected ancient civilizations that existed before our own, I think that there's also that realistic potential for Earth's future and how that may affect us on down the road just as well. We'll look at all of that during Hour 2 with Dr. Schock, and it's going to be a show to remember, let me tell you. But first, I've been racking my brain for the last few days, along with Caleb and Tyler. We all work very hard here in the bunker on various things, not just Gray Street, not just Grayling Report, not just the articles, not just the websites and all that sort of stuff, but we also function in the capacity of promoting for the Paradigm Symposium. It is probably the biggest block party bash of the esoteric that you're going to find anywhere that takes place every year in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I am so excited. You know, Dr. Schock, who's going to be our guest during Hour 2, he is going to be a speaker at this year's Paradigm Symposium. We've had a few other speakers on the program this year. Robert Bavall has been on with us. We've spoken recently with David Weatherly. You know, I'm going to be trying to get Marie D. Jones, Larry Flaxman, Scott Walter of History Channel's America Unearthed, a few of those kind of people on the program just as well. Of course, our good friend Scott Allen Roberts is a regular here on this program, and he's also someone who will be not only just speaking at Paradigm Symposium, but he and I, of course, are the Laurel and Hardy of the entire event. We're the guys who are up there actually doing the emceeing. And I'm always so excited at Paradigm Symposium because it's not just an incredible event where you get to get together and hear people like Robert Schock, who you're going to be hearing from during Hour 2. And you don't just get to hear them speak, you get to spend a little time with these people and hang around them. But then you also get to network with people. Let me just tell you, Paradigm Symposium, as we heard last week on the program, Darren and Graham of Grimerica Podcast, who joined us for almost a majority of the first hour last week, we met them at Paradigm Symposium, and that was kind of that, you know, where the floodgates broke open for them. Darren and Graham, that was the incident that set the precedent for them in terms of where they wanted to go in the future. And there are so many other people who I've spoken to who told me they came to Paradigm and they said, you know, I just came down to Minneapolis on a whim and I thought, this is going to be good. This looks great. We want to go down there. We want to see Eric Von Daniken, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Philip Coppens, you know, all the fine folks who are associated with the Ancient Aliens program. But they came down and they found so much more than just ancient aliens. They found so much more than just being able to meet these people that they see on television or the people whose books that maybe they've read for decades. You know, there were old school researchers who came down and who I was getting to hang out with and meet for the first time, but we were sitting there and having coffee. It felt more like a family reunion than a first meeting with a lot of these people. And that's what's so incredible about Paradigm Symposium is the people who came back from it and who spoke to me about it, they said, you know, there was this incredible sense of family. There was this incredible sense of oneness that we all shared. There was this incredible togetherness that we all had. And we all came away from that event feeling like our lives had actually changed. It was called the Paradigm Symposium, but we left that event feeling like we had gone through our own individual paradigm shifts. Caleb, you were there, and it was incredible for you because you weren't even a part of the Graylian to the extent that you're involved now. And yet you, nonetheless, I think you were swept up in that magic just as much as anyone else. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I think it was really not only an incredible, but a truly formative experience for all people who were there.
It was like being caught in a tornado of wizards' beards.
A tornado of wizards' beards or a bag full of cats, maybe, right?
It was wonderful. No, I mean, Paradigm was insane. I mean, you know, some people that went even ended up inadvertently possibly being on an episode of Ancient Aliens. I didn't see, but I mean, they were interviewing people from the audience. I mean, it was super cool. Just a great opportunity for people to actually like meet their idols, like Eric Von Daniken, who is never in America.
You know, there was this incredible thing that happened that first night that he arrived. He and his assistant, Ramon Zercher, who we loved. Ramon was so incredible. But Scotty and I ran downstairs to the hotel bar, and Von Daniken was there having his salad. And you know, he's older now. And I went up to him, and I mean, imagine what that was like, going up to him, shaking the hand of a legend. And I just told him, I said, listen, Eric, I'm so thankful that you're here. If there's anything you need, just let me know.
And he said, stop eating my sesame cake.
No.
Could you get me some more saltines for this salad?
No, he didn't say that either. Close. You guys are close, but no cigar. Not even a Swisher Sweet. No. What he said was, Mr. Von Daniken, thank you for coming, and let me know if you need anything. He says, no, stop this, stop. You do not call me Mr. Von Daniken. You call me Eric for next 3 days. I work for you. I'm Eric. And it was so humbling to hear this man who has written so many books, who has warped me, I mean, has changed so many minds, and he's sitting there saying, you know, you've got me for the next 3 days. Now, he ended up screaming at me at one point later on down the road. But I tell you, it got a little intense at times, but we all left that experience.
I just imagine.
That's what it sounded like. Yeah, it was over the telephone, but, you know. But it was incredible because, you know, no harm done. There were moments where it got a little intense because we were having to switch the schedules around and things like that, but... You know, I, like everyone else, came away from that thinking, my God, you know, we brought heaven to earth for a few days. And this year, last year was incredible, but there was this thrill factor of thinking, my God, we've got Eric Von Daniken and some of these people. And plus, it was the first Paradigm Symposium. It was the first time I'd ridden that pony, and I didn't really know entirely what to expect. Whereas this year, I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, wow, you know what? I got this. And I'm more excited about this year's Paradigm Symposium than... maybe even than last year. You know, and the other cool thing about this, and this may sound silly, but in all truth, one thing that I am so excited about Paradigm Symposium this year is that Tyler here, somebody who I've watched go through this progression, you know, the formulation of his own thought and his own intellect in regard to this sort of research for a decade or more. This guy, this is going to be your first... Well, you know, you actually have helped work conferences with me in the past. Caleb and I, you know, all three of us have, but... this is going to be your first Paradigm Symposium. This is going to be your first big time, you know, international conference. I mean, you've got
big
to be so
time.
Excited.
I am. You're going to be smiling right now.
You're going to be in the big time after this week. But I mean, you know, that's got to be exciting. That's got to be. I mean, you tell me, what are your expectations for Paradigm Symposium?
I expect to have a great time, meet a lot of like-minded researchers in the field, get to bond a little bit more with the Graylians in a different setting. So
this is something that I love so much about Paradigm Symposium, too. What you just said, Tyler, we get there. Red Pill Junkie is going to be able to be there. And, you know, of course, we're going to be doing a live broadcast, maybe more than one. You know, the KGRA Radio Network that hosts the Micah Hanks Show, we're in talks with them, and we plan to do live broadcasts from Paradigm Symposium. And it's going to be so incredible having not just the three of us that are the regular guys on this program, but, you know, in the very truest sense, Red Pill Junkie is, although mostly behind the scenes, he is so much a part of this. If you see this week's edition of Gray Street, he's literally fighting Hadels to the death to defend the guys sitting in this room right now. Now, granted, that takes place in the realm of fantasy, but if that were to ever really happen, if we were ever really trapped in the under earth and we were being accosted by subhumans, I think Red Pill Junkie would be the first to light a flare, crawl down into a hole, and fight them wearing nothing more than wrestling pants and a luchador mask.
People may not realize this, but everything that happens in Gray Street is real.
Yeah, it's all based on fact.
It all happens.
Yeah, it all really happens every week. But, you know, so we're going to be able to be doing a live broadcast, not just with Caleb and Tyler and I, but Red Pill Junkie is going to be live in studio with us in Minneapolis. Actually, it's St. Paul, but the Twin Cities are so damn close, sometimes I can't figure out which is which. He's going to be there with us, and we're going to all be there broadcasting together. And to have the fourth wheel of this vehicle we know as the Graylian Report, to have him there with us, it's just going to be so incredible. And Scott Roberts and John Ward, Dr. John, is going to be there, all the way from Luxor, Egypt. And you know, Scotty and John will be doing the Intrepid Radio program live. It's all going to be so incredible and enigmatic. And so I just have to tell people right now, if I understand correctly, a lot of the conferences out there are not doing very well right now. I've gotten a lot of figures from a lot of people, good people, people who work hard to put on events. And, you know, right now, the way that the economy is, tickets, you know, have not been selling quite as well to a lot of events. Paradigm Symposium, we're roughly double where we were last year.
That's excellent.
I mean, there are so many people who are so excited about this event, and I'm truly just thrilled. You know, that doesn't mean that there still isn't a lot of hard work that goes into it. That doesn't mean that there aren't still a lot of costs. A lot of costs that go into putting on an event like this. And there are some days where I wake up and I think, looking at what is before me and what I've got to get done, there are some days I wake up and I think, you know, sometimes I wish I had less involvement in this. But in the end, being able to go into an event hall and to walk out there and see people like you and have Caleb and Tyler and Scotty Roberts and all of us there, to walk into an event hall and to be able to all be there together and to be able to interact with people who listen, the thousands of people who attend, or rather they don't all attend the Paradigm Symposium, unfortunately, we wish you did, of the thousands who listen to this program on a weekly basis, you know, maybe 100 or so will make it to the Paradigm Symposium. I urge you, if you're listening right now, you've got to be one of those people. The people that we've met in the past, the people we will meet this year, the ones who email us every week and talk to us about their excitement about this show and their excitement about this event, the Paradigm Symposium, their excitement about Gray Street, their excitement about the Micah Hanks radio program, their excitement about everything that we work so hard to do and to bring to you. You don't want to miss this. You've got to be there with us, and we want you there. We want to be able to have this time with you, to sit down, to have a beer, you know, to have a cup of coffee, to even have breakfast. People, I remember David and Claudette Huber from Canada. Paradigm was the first event that they'd ever gone to last year, and they met us, and they were so thrilled. They were so excited because they listened to the program, and they'd never met us before, and we're sitting there talking with them, and I just invited them to have breakfast the next morning, and they couldn't believe it. And when we showed up down there, they said, we never thought in a million years we'd be sitting here having breakfast with Micah Hanks, Scotty Roberts, and Ben and Aaron from Mysterious Universe.
And they all eat dog kibble.
Yeah, they all eat dog food for breakfast. This is the weirdest thing. And David and Claudette, they took it one step further. They came all the way out to Arizona to the International UFO Congress in February just to catch up with Caleb and I. Well, of course, there were some fantastic speakers out there. David Hatcher-Childress not only was speaking but sharing a table with Caleb and I. But, you know, and we got to have breakfast again, and that's how it is. You know, you come down to Paradigm Symposium, I'm very busy. You'll see me usually as a red or a blue blur that runs in and out of the room twice an hour, but I'm there, and I invite people to come out, shake my hand, let's have a cup of coffee if we get a minute. I like to meet people. I want to meet you, and I want you to come to the Paradigm Symposium if you can. I think we've only got 19 of the banquet tickets, the biggest tickets left. There are only 19 of those. They're going to be gone probably in 2 weeks. If you want to be able to have dinner with us, you got to get those right now. But there are two other levels of tickets. There's a cocktail party that's going to be going on. That's not nearly as expensive as the banquet ticket. And then the baseline ticket, you know, you may not join the dinner or the cocktail party, but you're going to get to see every speaker and everything else that goes on at Paradigm Symposium, which includes, yes, having coffee with me if you want. And so all that's at ParadigmSymposium.com. You got to check that out. And of course, during hour two, we'll be talking with Robert Schock, who is one of our guests. Now, I know we're up almost on a break, but since in radio speak, this is a floating break, we're going to take three or four more minutes. I've got a few listener emails that I want to get to because I want to interact with people like you. Just as badly as I want to see you at Paradigm Symposium, I want to hear what you have to say right now. And so we'll start with Jesse, who writes and says, Dear Graylian Gang, I just listened to the last podcast and I had a bit of owl synchronicity I wanted to share with you. You know, allow me to interject here. Caleb and I were talking with Lauren Cutts at KGRA Radio Network prior to the broadcast, and he was even telling me, you know, Micah, it's funny because I've gotten to know Mike Cleland, and I've begun noticing these owl synchronicities too. So many people out there are talking about their own experiences with these owl synchronicities. Well, anyway, Jesse says, I've always been a believer in the paranormal, UFOs, Bigfoot. I've always been fascinated with alien encounters also and loved any movie that had anything to do with aliens. Well, so several years ago, my wife and I sat down one night to watch The Fourth Kind. Maybe a few of you out there have seen this. We both really were blown away by that movie, and we thought the whole owl connection was very interesting and talked a bit about it after the film. Well, just after talking about the owl element in the movie, I stepped outside to smoke a cigarette. It was nighttime, probably around 11 p.m. where I was, if I had to guess, and I stepped into my driveway to light my cigarette and noticed something out of the corner of my eye. On the edge of my driveway sits a fence that separates my neighbor's yard from mine, and just on the other side of this fence are the remains of an old tree that had fallen some few months ago. Now, you can see just the top of the tree over that fence, maybe 10 to 12 feet off the ground, and sitting on the top of that tree, staring over the fence, was a huge white owl. Now, when I say white, I mean this thing was ghostly white. It wasn't a barred owl with white and black or even the darker colors of feathers. Now, this owl was as white as snow. A snow owl? Maybe, but not this far north. A barred owl? Probably not. There were no bars visible on its feathers, and so I sat there frozen for a second or two, staring at this owl that was looking right back at me, and then it turned its head away and flew silently off into the night. Now, if you've ever seen the film The Fourth Kind, you'll understand how this can be a bit exciting and maybe even scary all at the same time. I just thought you'd enjoy the story, and yes, Jesse, we certainly did. I'm so intrigued by these owl encounters, I've even had one. Have you? We'd love to hear from you. info@graylianreport.com. Roger writes, Hi, I know there is a crossover between ETs and the spirit world and ufology. What I'd like to know is, what is the difference between the messages and the communication you get from angelic and spiritual guides, and differences and similarities from the messages and communication you might get from what we presume to be ETs? I bet a lot of people would love to know. I'm of the mind we can't always really differentiate, but I'd certainly like to know your ideas on this. I think the masses are probably confused about the difference between ET and spiritual beings. I hope somebody can provide some clarity here so that others can try to understand this too. Roger. You know, Roger, during the second segment of this hour, we're going to be talking a little bit about the work of William Cooper, the famous conspiracy theorist who met a rather strange and violent, untimely demise. I think, you know, he started off being one of the chief proponents of something that we talked about last week, the alleged Majestic 12 papers. We're going to start with a perspective on MJ-12 that incorporates Bill Cooper's research. But when we end up, you're going to notice that it gets further and further away from aliens, as William Cooper, love him or hate him, as many did in this field, his research got further and further from the idea that aliens were visiting us and that this was all terrestrial technology. But that did not remove the spiritual a portion of the equation, and he certainly felt that there was actually something going on that was, well, maybe what we would literally call a struggle for your soul. Mark writes, what do you think of Dyer's invitation to see his baby Bigfoot? Mark's writing about Rick Dyer, who claims to have a baby Bigfoot. Mark, here's what I think. Bunk. And if anything that we've seen in the past with Rick Dyer, who had been initially involved with the Bigfoot hoax that was all over Fox News, CNN, and all these other television stations, he and his buddy, I think the buddy's name was Matt Whitten. Rick Dyer and Matt Whitten, yes, they pulled off a hoax the first time, and this time I guarantee you there ain't no baby Bigfoot.
It's a bunkfoot.
Baby bunkfoot, maybe. Quinn the Eskimo writes, Micah, August 6th was a great show as always, and in the last minutes of the episode, you featured audio of Grant Cameron speaking about a Canadian report from Wilbert Smith circa 1950. Now, Cameron's reiteration of this report is somewhat taken out of context, I feel. This report is allegedly from the Canadian government, but the initial focus was not on UFOs, it was on geomagnetic technology. And he's right, by the way. I went and I read the report, and sure enough, this is exactly the premise of the memo. Quinn writes, I first read of this report back in the mid-80s in Leonard Stringfield's UFO Crash Retrievals Amassing the Evidence Status Report 3. Well, perhaps more interesting is the other information gleaned from author Bray, okay, who says, also note, Bray in his book relates that Smith was provided for research purposes a fragment allegedly obtained from an alien craft which had been shot off by USAF interceptors near Washington, D.C. in July of 1952. It's a bold claim indeed, Quinn writes. Does this last bit of information help solidify or does it damage Wilbert Smith's credibility? Like so much in this field, I suppose, that it's up to personal opinion. Your fellow in research, Quinn. And Quinn, thank you so much for sharing that with us. A couple more before we go to the break. Terrence writes, Graylian gang, just wanted to throw this out. I heard on your last podcast you mentioned a basketball conspiracy. Just wanted to say that the NBA conspiracies aren't as goofy as it may seem on the face. If you start with the 1986 draft, the first year there was a lottery, the first NBA conspiracy began with the cold envelope case where Stern allegedly rigged the draft so that New York would get Patrick Ewing with the first overall pick, thinking that for the NBA to succeed, he had to sell out to big markets like New York and LA. Now, of course, New York has since won zero titles and likely won't while I'm alive, a la Chicago clubs, but if you just look at the last 5 years of the NBA draft conspiracy, lines are evident. In fact, the NBA won their own draft lottery just a few years ago as a piece to the scale of New York or New Orleans Pelicans. Owner dies, and they get a pick. Lose LeBron, cry about it, you get a pick. And it goes on and on. It's also interesting to note, well, actually, he continues on talking about UFO sightings. I want to jump to another email here before we run out of time. That is interesting, you know, and at some point we'll have to get my good friend and colleague, one of the field correspondents for this program, Christopher McCollum, on the program, because he actually specializes in conspiracies and sports. Very, very interesting. And then finally, Mark, another Mark, writes, Mike, I enjoyed your article on conspiracies at Mysterious Universe, and I think you strike a balance between believing in none of them and believing in all of them. You're middle of the road, which I guess if that were an acronym, it would be M-O-T-R, which makes you a motor mouth. I see what you did there. He says, I'm sure you've seen the article in The Onion that published the classic story about believing in almost all JFK conspiracies, but of course they missed the most obvious one, that Nixon was in Dallas the same day and that he had the motive to shoot Kennedy. I take a contrarian position. MK Ultra was successful in proving that the Soviets also could not do mind control, and so maybe we were actually safe from there being a Manchurian candidate. What do you think? And I agree that conspiracy theories, because many of the facts are hidden, become a connect the dots to draw either a star or maybe you'd say a pentagon. I might say a pentagram, as found in the Principia Discordia. Thanks again, Mark. That's all we have from time for the listeners this week, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at a few other things, namely the conspiracies of William Cooper. He's a guy who's fascinated me for a long time, and I'm sure you'll agree. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Keep it here. We'll be back right after this. Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. And thus is the famous introduction of a once famous broadcast on shortwave radio that was none other than The Hour of the Time, hosted by the late William J. Cooper, conspiracy theorist, UFO buff, and of course also defender of the Constitution. He was quite controversial. You know, not a lot of people really loved him. I think that, a lot of people did, but a lot of people have also questioned him. Don Ecker, of course, the former publisher of UFO Magazine, had famously featured an expose on Cooper. And so there were a lot of questions about who exactly William Cooper was and what his involvement in, well, what you might call all of this actually had been. He had written one of the most famous tracts on conspiracy theories ever, which was known as Behold a Pale Horse. It's been described by some as one of the most elaborate conspiracy theories of all time. And of course, he was known for having a lot of controversial opinions about conspiracies and things that were going on in the world around us. For instance, he believed that AIDS was indeed a manufactured virus that was created for purposes of population control. Of course, he had also been an early advocate of what we talked about on the program last week, Majestic 12, and then later began to change his position on the alien component with all this. Now, as a brief addenda to last week's program, I have to say this. I remember years and years ago reading a document which was referred to also in Behold a Pale Horse by Cooper. It was known as Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. This book was, and you can find the entire thing online in the show notes this week. We will link to an entire listed bibliography, if you will, called the William Cooper Files, that gives you access to just about everything that Cooper ever spoke about and believed. And Cooper, again being the controversial character that he was, I always remembered Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars and found it very interesting, and I just thought after last week's program, nothing again in relation to what we'd talked about on last week's program, but we've been talking for a while about doing a program that kind of looks at the life of Cooper, and we're only going to be able to get to a spattering of it this week. Really, you could do several shows on William Cooper and his involvement in the formation of attitudes toward political conspiracies in America today. He was truly, again, one of the most influential guys out there. But I came across something very interesting as I was digging around and looking into a bit of background on this Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. Now, for those who aren't familiar with what this actually was, this is a, I guess it was described by one who had allegedly authored the manuscript as, quote, a politically biased technical instruction manual on how to justify, how to selectively survive human-animal husbandry before the need for animal husbandry becomes unstably critical. It's rather chilling the way that that's termed, and where this actually comes from was a series of correspondences that were written to Paranoia magazine. Now, Paranoia magazine has been known as the conspiracy and paranormal reader since about 1993, I think, is maybe when they went into print. Do you know,
Tom?
I
think it was 91, possibly. I think they may have put something out earlier.
Yeah, they at least were around by the early 1990s.
Yeah, I know there are 93 issues.
Around the same time that, you know, Clinton took office, and of course around the same time that William Cooper was really emerging onto the scene. He was already speaking at UFO lecture circuits and things like that by the late 80s. By 1993, I believe he had begun the Hour of the Time radio broadcast. Now, Paranoia magazine went under a few years ago, and then it kind of had a comeback once Ron Patton, who had been planning his own conspiracy magazine, had contacted the former owners of the magazine Paranoia, and they said, look, you know, Ron, why don't you just buy us out and take over Paranoia? Caleb and I met Ron at the International UFO Congress this year, and he actually asked me, you know, hey, man, I'm a fan. We should get you hooked up, and you should start doing some writing. And I said, hey, Ron, I'm a fan. I'd love to do some writing. And so, you know, with a mutual appreciation for one another, Ron and I became friends. And Ron's doing a great job. You know, if you haven't seen the new website for Paranoia, just get on Google and search Paranoia Mag, but I think it is paranoiamag.com. And it's a fantastic magazine if you're into some fringe weirdness. And some of the political conspiracies they get into get far out there. But whether you believe all of it, I have to say it's quite entertaining. Now, I had incidentally written an article recently that I sent to Ron that deals with some of the modern interpretations of the mythos and the misinformation surrounding MJ-12. Completely apart from that, I decided to look into this document that I'd read many years ago when a friend lent me this little pamphlet version of Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars that was produced, I think, by a Southern, probably an evangelical organization, a small printing press. And the story about this was that this document had allegedly been found in a typewriter that had been found, I think it was a copy machine actually, purchased in 1986 at McChord Air Force Base. And the story goes is that this was just found in this typewriter, and conspiracy, or rather paranoia, decided to put this out to their readers and try and find out if anyone knew who the actual author of the document might be. Now, what they wrote was that in 2003, Paranoia excerpted a pamphlet, the entire pamphlet known as Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, and when they put it out to their readers for information about who may have authored this work, they received, in December of that year, a letter that, get this, had been mailed from a federal prison, and the man who had written the letter was named Hartford Van Dyke, wherein he exposes what he claims are the circumstances surrounding his authorship of the infamous pamphlet. So he begins writing, and he starts talking about Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars and talking about what this document actually entailed. He described it as, quote, an elite blueprint. There's nothing dubious about it, he says. The protocols of the learned elders of Zion was not used as a reference for the pamphlet. And in the end of your first paragraph, referencing an article that Paranoia had featured on it, they say you hone in on the technical essence of the Silent Weapons manuscript, similar to the November 1986 release advertisement, but your second paragraph suggested that you're unaware of an APN article comment that described the document as a paranoid manifesto. He says it's not an accurate description of what this book was, and it's clear from reading that section. Well, anyway, he gets on into the psychology and the psychoanalysis of the document and described it again as being, quote, a politically biased technical instruction manual on how to justify and how to selectively survive human-animal husbandry before the need of animal husbandry becomes unstably critical. Now, what's interesting is that after putting forth this definition, he then mentions William Cooper. Now, this is a logical next thing to do because Cooper, again, had, if I remember correctly, I think he excerpted the pamphlet in his book, Behold a Pale Horse. But interestingly, this is what Hartford Van Dyke says about Cooper and how Cooper may have come upon this. He says, Cooper might have read Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars in a Naval Intelligence Majority 12 file. Majority 12. Now, of course, that sounds so much like Majestic 12. And knowing Cooper's tie-ins with having claimed to have seen Majestic 12 files, I decided to go and look back at some of this. And sure enough, Operation Majority was something that William Cooper often spoke about. Operation Majority, and of course, Majesty 12, or Majority 12. Now get this, the very disinformationist Richard Doty, who had supplied the original MJ-12 documents to William Moore in 1987, when the whole Majestic 12 thing broke. Get this, Richard Doty, many actually say that he was the very perpetrator of the hoax itself. Richard Doty actually said, at that time, MJ is not Majestic. Although, of course, Bill Cooper had said that he had seen such files labeled under a kind of a heading that was magic with a J. But Richard Doty said MJ didn't stand for Majestic. It stood for Majority, Majority 12. I find it interesting. And there's no way to say that even a letter written by this guy, Hartford Van Dyke, from a federal prison and sent to Paranoia Magazine in 2003, there's no real way to say whether or not that could have been influenced by the MJ-12 hoax, too, and that it's just the ongoing continuation and propaganda of conspiracy as perpetrated by people who are playing into the hoax, whether just for entertainment or for other some sort of bizarre and twisted reason. You can't rule that out. But it is interesting that Cooper claimed that he'd seen documents that were designated with a level, essentially a clearance level, you know, a code word that was entailing magic with a J. And then there's this MJ-12, which this Hartford Van Dyke guy referred to as Majority 12 and said Cooper may have seen Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars in a Majority 12 document. And then Richard Doty was out there saying, yeah, but MJ wasn't Majestic or, you know, Majestic 12. It was Majority 12. I thought that was incredibly interesting, looking into all this. Very strange. Very odd. But what even is stranger, coming back to Bill Cooper about all this, is, again, early on, because of his alleged exposure to these documents, and of course having, during his Navy years, while aboard a nuclear submarine, actually claimed that he had seen a UFO-type craft, a saucer, emerge from the ocean and then fly back down, and the water parted as this thing entered as though it were being moved aside for entry so that the object wouldn't be torn to shreds as it collided with the water at high speed. You know, Cooper was very much a proponent of the ET hypothesis. When he would go out there in 1989 when he spoke at, the Las Vegas MUFON Symposium, he was up there, and the entire snippet is featured online. As a matter of fact, we have a very brief audio soundbite of that, which we feature each week during the introduction to the Micah Hanks program. But Cooper, when he was out there, that was the entire crux of his program. There were four different species of extraterrestrial aliens visiting Earth. You know, all this, their underground bases, Dulce at Area 51. That was what Cooper was talking about initially. And I remember hearing those speeches and just thinking, yeah, right. Prove it. But what's interesting about Cooper is that as he went along with his research, later in his years, he began to back away from the extraterrestrial hypothesis, much like J. Allen Hynek had done at times, much like Dr. Jacques Vallée has done. You know, having a correspondence via email with Brad Steiger recently, he and I were talking about how this, whatever it is, goes so much deeper than little alien guys visiting from another planet. There's something going on, but it's something a lot deeper. Something a lot deeper than aliens, you know what I mean? Because I just don't think that looking at aliens as the answer to the mystery accounts for all of its various aspects. And so when we look at aliens in relation to UFOs, I'm one of these guys myself who's backed away from that, as the listenership of this program knows. And Cooper, as he went along, he got to be the very same way. Cooper began, after a point, to say, you know, I don't know that we can say that this is really ET. He started taking people out there, and they would park up on a hill, and they would watch Area 51 long before the military had actually disclosed what Area 51 was or that it was even there. And they would film, and they would watch these strange aircraft being maneuvered out there over the base. And Cooper started thinking more and more, you know what, I don't know that this is something extraterrestrial. I think these things could be from right here. I think that our government knows more about what's going on. And he was appalled by the notion that he may have even been one of the very perpetrators of the so-called ET meme.
He's not saying it's aliens. It's aliens.
Well, he was saying it was government. He was saying, less and less do I acknowledge an ET component, and more I begin to think that there's something that our government does know more about. You know, maybe we can't rule out aliens, but it's also difficult to rule out the idea that the most likely explanation, even though these appear to be technologies that we don't have, it appears to be a technology that is on Earth. Could it be from Earth? A lot of people still have a hard time believing that and accepting that, but we don't know what we're dealing with. It could be a number of different things, but isn't it just as much of a logical leap just because we're dealing with something that appears to be greater than anything we know to exist? Is there not a logical leap involved with the assumption that what we actually are seeing is maybe from right here? And so Cooper started looking at that too and thinking, you know what? This just, something's not right. And that took him off into the realm of the conspiracy and the government conspiracy. And it took him into the realm of warning against the, you know, not to sound like a lot of the other conspiracy hosts out there, but I have to say it, to warn against the threat of tyranny. People don't think that could ever happen here in the United States. And actually, to tell you the truth, in a lot of aspects, we're really close to it. Did you guys see earlier this week that there was a court ruling that has struck down in New York what's known, or what had been known as, stop and frisk? Have you seen this? We've got an article about it at MicahHanks.com.
Stop right there, slave.
Yeah, stop right there, slave.
Frisk you.
Well, think about this. I mean, this is something that Mayor Michael Bloomberg had said that had been, you know, highly effective in preventing crimes. And what they were doing is they were going out there, and if a police officer sees a person that they think is a person of interest,
of color,
or we'll get to that in a minute. If we see a person that we perceive as being a person of interest, we can stop them, we can search them, we can go through their pockets. It wasn't just in New York, folks. You know, anyone who's been following the Micah Hanks program, you know, we've on two different occasions talked about there were two incidents in Texas where there were young women in their late 20s and early 30s that were literally cavity searched, okay, by the side of the road, and the female officer that was literally conducting the genital search didn't change gloves in between searches. It also happened in Milwaukee. It also happened in Florida.
Yeah, I was about to say, didn't another one happen just recently?
I mean, they continue to happen. And what the attorneys who are defending these women are saying is that, you know, we're seeing this, and the proof of it is not just in the testimony by the young women. The proof is in the dash cam footage that was later produced and which led to the suspension of some of the officers involved. But the thing is that they're going about this in different states, at least twice in Texas. The same procedure is carried out by the side of the road in full view of oncoming traffic. And what the attorneys defending these people who are, you know, again, taking the police departments and officers to court for what they call an unconstitutional search, they're saying, yes, what we are dealing with here is something that has become procedural. They are carrying out a procedure, and somewhere along the line, somebody told these officers that this was okay to do and that this would be routine procedure. In one of the instances where the women were cavity searched, they were pulled over on suspicion of apparently speeding. No ticket was issued, but the officer after the fact said that he'd seen what looked like a cigarette go out the window before he pulled them over.
And that's littering!
And that's littering, and therefore we've got to put our finger in every bodily orifice that you may have. You know, listen, let me tell you something, folks. If you're not familiar with the Fourth Amendment, okay, there were protections by our founding fathers instituted against that sort of thing, what we call illegal search and seizure. Okay, there were protections that were meant to provide that if a law enforcement officer is going to arrest or detain an individual, they have to have a warrant, and what they have to also have is probable cause. That's what the Fourth Amendment entails. When we have officers of the law who are going out there and stopping and frisking people in broad daylight just because they look like a person of interest, and yes, I want to get around to what you were alluding to, Tyler. Yes, this has been ruled unconstitutional, not even so much on the violation of the Fourth Amendment as the obvious prejudices that have been exposed. I think approximately 80% of the millions who have been stopped since 2004, I believe, in the stop and frisk program in New York, about 80% have been blacks or Latinos. And so, yes, indeed, it appears that there's been a bit of stereotyping and profiling involved just as well. Thank God a court finally has said, yes, you know what, this is unconstitutional. Hello, folks. It doesn't take much to figure that one out. But let me tell you something. People have said to me in the past, okay, well, Michael, why are you talking about this? This is a podcast about the paranormal. Folks, if we don't talk about this on this podcast, there won't be a podcast. If we don't talk about this in every instance where we can, publicly, every time I'm able to get behind a microphone and every time I'm able to bring the truth to people like you, if we don't work together to ensure these freedoms, a podcast like this one won't exist. Websites like the Graylian Report or the Micah Hanks Program, they won't exist. The internet, we won't have access to it. And sometimes, folks, the truth of the matter is, yes, we do have to get serious. Sometimes we have to get serious, and it's not always pretty. Sometimes it's downright ugly, but we have to. And I'm not trying to scream at you, but I do want to impress upon you that when you start seeing the rudiments of tyranny erupting into your society, you can do something about it. You can talk about it, and you can recognize it, and you can stop it, like we're trying to do right here. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. We'll be back right after this. According to the Maya, the rain god Chalk created the vast oceans as he struck the clouds with his axe in ancient times. Some believe today that there may be more to these myths of strange beings, but no modern adventure will explore mysteries of our ancient past like the Ancient Alien Cruise, January 9th through the 13th, 2014. Set sail for a high seas adventure with experts in ancient mysteries and ancient astronaut theories, including author David Hatcher Childress, Dr. Robert Schock, and Hugh Newman. Go where mysteries of the ancients await you, along with a privately led shore excursion to Mayan ruins and a one-of-a-kind fine dining experience with your guides and speakers aboard one of the specialty restaurants on deck. Sign up early to ensure the speaker of your choice, and reservations made by September 1st will receive $25 per cabin onboard credit. The Ancient Alien Cruise will depart from Fort Lauderdale. Airfare, travel, and insurance is not included, but call for additional pricing and amenities. For details, visit ancientaliencruise.com or call Holiday Maker Travel toll-free at 877-642-4308. Embrace the spirit of adventure. ancientaliencruise.com.
Ranger Station.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting in the forest.
Uh-huh.
1 second I'm having a smoke. Next thing I know, I'm face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Wow.
And he told me it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
Did you know 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans?
I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous and you're not. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Gray Alien Report with Caleb and Tyler. Wrapping up this hour, and do please stick around. Dr. Robert Schock is going to be on with us in the second hour. You know, I get the impression that Robert is going to not only be at Paradigm Symposium, but he's also going to be on an upcoming cruise. You may have heard that little advert we've been playing here on the program for the Ancient Alien Cruise. Well, there's a website for it just as well, and we've got it linked there at the Gray Alien Report. You might want to go check that out. Take a peek. Because, again, if you've ever wanted to go sail the high seas and also hang with some of the brightest minds in the field of the ancient and the esoteric, Ancient Alien Cruise is probably the place that you're going to find that. Very interesting. Welcome back. I'm Micah Hanks. Now, again, we were talking last segment about William Cooper, but again, I think also that the more important thing is that a lot of people look at guys like William Cooper or Alex Jones or me for that matter, and they'll say, you know, these people are just, they're just out there just, you know, riding their high horse, they're fear-mongering. You know, that's exactly the opposite of what I try to do. I never am going to sit here and tell you, folks, you really got to worry. You've got to worry because you know what? Your food supply is going to be gone. Folks, the electromagnetic pulse is going to take out the electrical grid and you're not going to have the amenities that are provided for you on a day-to-day basis. You're not going to have any of that stuff.
But I, on the other hand, will scare the crap out of you with this headline, Dead Recluse Eaten by Own House Cats!
No!
Yeah, that is pretty scary, Caleb. Oh, you know, yeah, see, fear-mongering. That's what we're going to give Caleb his own show. We're going to give Caleb his own show, and then Caleb can do all the fear-mongering for us.
Yeah,
look at him turning red in the face over there.
I'm pretty good at that.
Oh, God. You know, but I mean, it's true. I mean, there are so many people who'll just sit out there. I mean, whether it be...
I'm sorry. That is the funniest... I'm going to take a little bit of time on the air right now to show you this picture of... that goes along with Dead Recluse Eaten by Own House Cats.
Caleb, would you like to just go ahead? Let's just take that. Let's go ahead and get the news out. Tell us what exactly happened to the dead recluse. Well, I guess we all know already, don't we?
Consumed by feline.
Consumed by house cat. Wow, that's not the way I thought the apocalypse was going to come about. We're all going to be eaten by house cats.
Everybody that follows us on Twitter knows that every once in a while I like to post a new goblin. Today's was Trantor, but this house cat might be the new one.
Wait a minute, you post a new goblin?
Yeah, I post goblins every once in a while at the Graylian Twitter, and today's was Trantor.
You know, so, folks,
it's a daily goblin.
There's so many... the daily goblin. You know, there's so many different avenues to entertainment that we provide for you on this program. Get your daily goblin with the Graylian on Twitter. Okay, so a recluse was eaten by... I mean, presumably the recluse died first and then...
Oh, you still want me to read this?
Not really, but go ahead.
It was the body of a recluse British woman was gnawed and eaten by her starving pets after she died, according to a coroner's...
Well, at least she died first.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff probably happens all the time, but it's like pet lobsters and stuff.
Gosh. You know,
you're not going to get your fancy feast if your person is dead. So
well, like
I understand
that snake that killed two kids last week.
That was awful.
Yeah, that was really terrible. Yeah, and for folks who if you haven't heard about that, was it a Burmese python? I don't remember.
It was a mean python.
It was a big mean snake, is what it was. It escaped from through a ventilator shaft. It escaped from a pet store and crawled up into an apartment above. And killed a 5 and a 7-year-old boy. You know, just terrifying. You know, I hear down there in Florida right now that the Burmese python has become such an invasive threat because they breed worse than rabbits.
Yeah, that's why they down there, honestly, they say they have a lot of this like infrared camera and sensors type things so they can like hunt them down stealthily. I mean, they've destroyed the ecosystem down there.
Yeah, well, you know,
that's
I mean,
what reptilians will do.
That's exactly what reptilians do. They want to destroy our ecosphere. Oh, gosh, as I almost screamed just now. But anyway.
Well, Gio was talking about in the chat room, there's a fish that they took out of some natural habitat. Ugh. I can't remember exactly what lake it was, but they put him in this other lake, and literally, it's like natural food that it would eat was like some kind of like circular fruit, and people, and these fish have teeth, and people that would get in that lake, men, would have their bits and pieces attacked. And sometimes
mutilated.
Ripped off by these fish.
A cool, refreshing dive led to a bite on the twig and berries. Well,
not just a bite.
Not just a bite, yeah, good. Well, yeah, exactly.
That sounds like one of those stories like, oh, I fell down the stairs, really. It's like Lorraine is living at home with the dude.
All you hear is,
oh, well, yeah. Speaking of Gio, you know, he sent us a story before we went to air here. Talking about the actual stories that the journalist Michael Hastings might have been working on prior to his death, they're saying that Michael Hastings had apparently been, get this, there has been up to this point a lot of speculation about what exactly he'd been writing, and I think maybe a couple of news sources by now have carried this story, so some of you out there may know what was going on. Of course, those of you picking up the podcast, this story will have been a couple of days old anyway, maybe a couple of weeks. I know that there's a longevity to these broadcasts.
But still probably weeks ahead of the mainstream.
You know, we are often weeks ahead of not just the... At the very least, I will give us this. We're often days ahead of the mainstream. And I often also find that the Graylian Report, in terms of putting up news on the daily news, up there on the website, and talking about them on the shows, we usually beat a lot of the other news sites. Of course, I mean, then again, mainstream news sites usually aren't looking for this kind of information as quickly and readily as we are, but a lot of the time we beat them to the punch, too. But what they're saying, according to the Daily Caller, is that Michael Hastings had been working on an expose on the CIA director John Brennan. And San Diego 6 out of, well, San Diego, has reported this. Now, the article first confirmed by Hastings' widow, Elise Jordan, on CNN it's expected to be published in an upcoming issue of Rolling Stone. And the crux of it, apparently, is this. Brennan was implicated in an alleged internal email from private intelligence firm Strat4, published by WikiLeaks, as the head of the federal government's crackdown on investigative journalists when he served as the White House counterterrorism advisor. So imagine that. Here was this expert on, well, I guess, you know, really, after, what was Hastings' book? I Lost My Love in Baghdad? Was that it?
That was the book, but the thing that kind of propelled him was the profile he did on General McChrystal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which basically told, kind of gave a narrative of these generals or majors just making a giant playland out of the Middle East where money was going, it was being reallocated to it, just disappearing. It was insane.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I've even had people, you know, who watch the crisis going on in the Middle East right now. And I've had a lot of people tell me over the years that really, whoever they are, the globalists, the global elite, what they're thriving on and what their end game is to maintain instability in the Middle East. That because, you know what, in that part of the world, that kind of instability is profitable. Too bad we lose lives in doing so. Look, I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be talking about the ancient Middle East with Robert Schock when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
In 2013, mysteries of the past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Speakers will include Scott Wolter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at ParadigmSymposium.com. Mankind's greatest mysteries brought to the present with new understanding. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
Imagine no longer being tied down to your computer, but having the freedom to take live talk radio with you anywhere you go. TalkStream Live introduces our first ever iPhone application. The talk shows you follow now follow you, and your iPhone is now the fastest and easiest way to stay connected to the best talk radio on the internet. Let TalkStream Live transform the way you listen to radio. Listen to live talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mobile talk radio from TalkStream Live. Now available in the iTunes App Store.
This is the Graylion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylion Report. Always glad to be keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Along with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. Tyler, I'm extremely excited about our guest tonight.
Yes, that ought to be a great segment.
It's going to be a fantastic segment. You know, we've had a few of our speakers that are slated for Paradigm Symposium this year on the program already, including the very wonderful Dr. Robert Bavall. I would have to say I think I'm probably more excited than anyone about the guest that we have tonight. Robert Schock, Ph.D., is a tenured faculty member at Boston University. Now, he earned his doctorate in geology and geophysics at Yale University in 1983. That was the year I was born. And his books include Pyramid Quest, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, Voices of the Rocks, Stratigraphy, Environmental Science, and the Parapsychology Revolution. His latest book is the book that we'll be discussing with him this evening on the Graylion Report, which is Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. And therefore, it is with extreme delight that I welcome to the program for the first time Dr. Robert Schock. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So glad to have you, and I'm so looking forward to delving into this a bit with you, because indeed we definitely have a very intriguing discussion ahead of us. Now, of course, for those who are not entirely familiar with you and your work, as I am, tell us a little bit about how you got into this and what led you to study the mysteries of the ancient world. Where did the fascination begin?
Well, it depends on how far you want to go back. I won't go into great detail, but I've actually had an interest in such things from a very, very young age. My grandmother was a theosophist. She's deceased now, but she was actually an old school theosophist. And if anyone knows about theosophy, that ties right in with sort of an interest in the ancient mysteries. So I was introduced to this at a very early age, but I went an academic route. I went to college. I went to graduate school at Yale, as you mentioned. I earned ultimately my PhD in geology and geophysics, and then I went to Boston University, where I still teach full-time as a tenured faculty member. And I was doing my thing, you know, teaching science, teaching geology. And then in the late 1980s, I met John Anthony West. And you or some of your listeners may know who that was. He's a, I would call him an independent Egyptologist. He calls himself a rogue Egyptologist. And he started discussing the Sphinx with me, the Great Sphinx, and suggested that I go to Egypt to look at the Sphinx from a geological perspective. So I first did that in 1990, and lo and behold, the geology said something very different than what the Egyptologists were saying. When I analyzed the Sphinx geologically, it became very clear to me that the oldest portions of it go well beyond 2500 BC, which is the classical date for the Sphinx, according to Egyptologists. And this led me on the path that I've been continuing ever since, so for the last nearly a quarter century, looking at ancient cultures, ancient civilizations around the world.
You know, it is indeed so interesting to me when someone has that early influence and then they take it from there. They go out there and they actually go to seek to try and understand what's going on in the world around them, as you have done. Now, with your latest book, Dr. Shock, you know, again, the subtitle is The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Our Future. But, of course, there is an image of the Sphinx on the cover. And so I thought we might begin there, because I know that this is one thing that you're probably not only best known for, but, you know, to an extent, I'm sure that you may grow tired of having to always talk about that. But it is so fascinating. So I would love to begin there and talk a bit about the role that the Sphinx plays in all this, and especially in your research, because your theories about that are entirely revolutionary.
Okay, well, we can talk about that. So, as I was just saying, I was introduced to the Sphinx and to these types of studies by John Anthony West. This was back in the late 1980s. I first traveled to Egypt in 1990 to study the Sphinx explicitly and specifically. That's what I went to Egypt on, that initial trip to do, to study it from a geological perspective. And part of my training in graduate school, part of my training professionally, is to look at weathering and erosion. And to make a long story short, I realized very quickly, just on the first trip, that the weathering and erosion that you see on the Sphinx is incompatible with the climate, what we see in northern Africa, what we see in Egypt over the last 5,000 years, ever since dynastic times. So immediately this suggested to me that the oldest portions of the Sphinx must go back to an earlier climatic regime. And I pursued that further. I carried out a number of geological studies. A fellow named Thomas DeBecchi, a geophysicist, and myself carried out seismic studies around the Sphinx so we could look at subsurface data and analyze that. And everything pointed to the conclusion, and again, this is early 1990s, that the Sphinx itself, the oldest portions of the Sphinx, and I want to be careful, make sure everyone's clear, the Sphinx has a human head that is not the original head, and the paws have been reworked, that type of thing. But the oldest portions go back thousands of years earlier than 2500 BC. At this point, I am contemplating, and I'm not adverse to the notion that the oldest portions actually go back over 10,000 years to the end of the last ice age. So this really got me started on this path, which has been very controversial in some circles, because civilization, according to standard chronology, conventional status quo thinking, only goes back about 3,000 to 4,000 BC. And I've been saying for decades now that no, there's evidence that we have high culture, sophisticated civilization at a much earlier date. And we're now finding evidence of that around the world otherwise.
You know, that just fascinates me, though. And the reason for that is because, again, we're talking here about the potential that there were civilizations, you say, perhaps as far back as 10,000 years.
Oh, over 10,000 years. Well, I will put it very simply right now. We have in Turkey, and we can talk about this if you like, we have in Turkey a site known as Göbekli Tepe, which I've now visited a number of times, and this site is well dated to 10,000, 9,500, in that range, B.C., so we're talking 12,000 years ago. The oldest portions of it go back to what we call geologically the last ice age, the Younger Dryas technically, but the last ice age. And so we have civilization and sophisticated civilization, I'm convinced, over 12,000 years ago, about 10,000 plus B.C., and this is just a really radical notion, but the evidence is there, the data is there.
You know, and that's just incredible to me. I've always been so fascinated with that possibility that there were worlds, maybe to borrow the words of Brad Steiger, worlds before our own. Dr. Shock, when you talk to people, you know, your contemporaries, are they ever skeptical about this? Are you met with contemptuous attitudes when you say yes?
Oh. I've had more than my share of contemptuous attitudes and skepticism, but I think I'm being proven correct now with the data that's coming out. I'll give you a quick example. 1992, 1991, I first really went public with my redating of the Sphinx. I gave a major presentation at the Geological Society of America. This was 1991, so a long time ago now. And it was crowded, you know, packed room, lots of geologists there. Geologists tend to be very critical of data. They have no compunction telling you if they think you're wrong. And I presented my data. I presented my analysis and my conclusions that the Sphinx goes back much earlier. To a person, the geologist agreed with me. They all agreed with me, but I realized in hindsight they had no particular vested interest. They didn't really care in an ultimate sense how old the Sphinx was because it wasn't their turf. It didn't step on their toes to say that the Sphinx was older. So they could go very objectively by the data. When I presented it not long afterwards to Egyptologists within the venue of an Egyptological conference, I was attacked vehemently. And Egyptologists were even telling me, well, they don't know geology, they can't disprove me, but they know I must be wrong. So, you know, it really depends in many ways what your vested interests are, where you're coming from, and or at least my critics, where they're coming from.
Well, you know, I think that one of the reasons that you've probably been met with skepticism in the past is because you are open-minded about things. For instance, you know, in the new book, Forgotten Civilization, you mention, for instance, that although you actually have scientific data that backs up the possibility that there may have been or that there may be right now a chamber beneath the Sphinx, Edgar Cayce had also apparently predicted this, and that this is kind of a point of contention among the hardcore skeptics. But you know, if even nothing more than for the synchronistic aspect, it's difficult to deny the fact that Cayce made this prediction, and then you have scientific data that you feel that actually promotes that idea.
And in fact, this is a very interesting case because some of my critics may not want to believe it, but the truth is, when we collected this subsurface data, I was not looking for chambers. I was not looking to prove that Cayce was correct. I was actually looking for subsurface data to help with my analysis of how old the Sphinx is. We simply found the chamber because it happens to be there, and we were doing seismic studies in the vicinity. So it was obvious, you know, when you do seismic, well, the techniques we were using, if there was a chamber there, we were going to find it. But we did not suspect that there was a chamber there. We found it. We were, surprised. It actually wasn't that big a deal to me at the time because it's not what I was looking for. It's not what I was particularly interested in. And at the time, I knew who Edgar Cayce was. I wasn't totally naive about such things. And, you know, I'd actually had some... I don't want to say experience, some reference to Edgar Cayce in the terms of how he had done remote healing, etc. But I was actually not versed in Edgar Cayce's specific prophecies about where halls of records or chambers would be found, and I did not know at the time that there was supposed to be one in the vicinity of the Sphinx. So I found that, or Thomas DeBecky and I found it independently, of knowing about Edgar Cayce's prophecy.
You know, then that's, again, what's so interesting to me is that there is this potential connection there. Whether or not one chooses to say, hey, Cayce was right.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, again, you can't deny the fact that there is that parallel to be made.
We found it. He said it was there decades earlier. Make what you will of it.
Yes, indeed. Well, Dr. Schock, wait with us right there. When we come back, I want to get more into the primary theory in your book, which is that these ancient civilizations not only existed, but that perhaps our sun played a role in their demise, which is in itself an incredibly interesting concept. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. We'll be back with Dr. Robert Schock here in just a moment. Stay with us.
Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Welcome back to the Graylian Report. I am Micah Hanks, and we're continuing our discussion, a very interesting discussion tonight, with Dr. Robert Schock. He's the author of Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. Indeed, it's a fascinating discussion, as I knew it would be, and here in a moment we want to get into the possibility that not only there were ancient civilizations, but also that just maybe some of those civilizations were affected by hijinks perpetrated by Earth's sun. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Schock.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, halfway through this segment, if we've got a little time, it might be interesting to open the phone lines. And if you'd be okay with that, we may put the phone lines out to folks. But I have a few more questions first. I do want to get into this crux of the matter with your book, in which you state that that perhaps mass coronal ejections produced by our sun could have been detrimental to ancient civilizations that existed long ago. Am I correct in this understanding?
You are absolutely correct. In fact, I believe that all the evidence points to this being the case. We were talking about my early work on ancient civilizations, pushing back ancient civilizations, and what I see, based on the data, and I'm very much one for following the data, wherever it may lead. What I see is that based on the data, we have evidence, be it Turkey, southeastern Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, be it Egypt with my work on the Great Sphinx, and then other evidence that we won't get into now around the world, of a major civilization, sophisticated culture at the very end of the last ice age. So think in terms of about 10,000 BC. Geologically, it's been a big issue. Why did the ice age end? Why did it end so dramatically? We now have very good isotope data. And when I say now, this is within the last few years, just the last few years, based on, for instance, Greenland ice cores, that the ice age ended about 9700 or so BC very, very rapidly, within a matter of just a couple of years. Literally, because we can't resolve the data that tightly, it may have been overnight or just within a few days, a few weeks. And there is lots of indications, be it isotope data, be it geological data, that what happened, what caused this massive change in climate, massive warming on the surface of the Earth, was a major solar outburst, or actually a series of major solar outbursts that melted the glaciers, caused climatic changes. Actually, it would have driven coronal mass ejection, a CME, down to the surface, which would have caused a major electrical sparking, actually probably powerful enough to set forest fires, that type of thing. And this would have been absolutely devastating to civilizations at the time. And to make a long story short, as I discuss in my book, I believe this essentially wiped out these early civilizations, sort of drove them back down to a very low level, and we went into a dark age, if you would, for literally thousands of years. And what archaeologists classically have seen as the emergence or the beginning of civilization between about 4,000 and 3,000 BC is not the first civilization, but that's a reemergence of civilization after we'll call it the Dark Age, lasting thousands of years.
Hmm. You know,
so that's the story in a nutshell.
In a nutshell. Well, I've always kind of wondered about that. You know, a lot of other alternative history theories have involved such things as the idea of nuclear events in the ancient past. I've even written about this, and I've wondered, because I think a lot of people have interpreted this literally as meaning that maybe there were not just nuclear events, but maybe there were actually nuclear weapons in ancient time. Do you think that a more plausible theory is that the nuclear events emanated from the sun, or do you think that there were...
Or do I think what? I didn't let you finish.
Oh, that's okay. No, or do you think that there is at all a possibility that civilizations were so advanced that they actually had harnessed such...
I don't have the evidence right now, so I like to stick with the evidence, and I don't see solid, good evidence that the civilizations at that time were so advanced that they had nuclear weapons. And what I see right now is we do have evidence that could be interpreted as nuclear weapons, but it can be interpreted other ways, you know, besides nuclear weapons. I'll give you one example. That's vitrification, and I talk about it a little bit in the book, but the concept of vitrification, or melting of rock, and then it re-solidifies. And this you have when you have nuclear weapons. We've seen that, unfortunately, in the 20th century. But you could also get that from a major solar outburst. And I believe that the evidence that we're picking up of vitrification at actually a number of archaeological sites that span the end of the last ice age is the evidence, or is evidence, of a major, major solar outburst at that time, not of nuclear weapons.
Well, again, you know, that's so incredible unto itself, because when we talk about vitrification, again, we're talking about the literal melting of rock and fusing sometimes of stones together. I know that Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa and some of those ancient Pakistani, whether it's in modern-day Pakistan, but a lot of those...
Yeah, modern Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And also you get it, for instance, very prominently in some of the, what they call hill forts in Scotland in particular, and Wales in the UK, and France, Germany. In fact, you find it a number of places around the globe.
You know, and I guess the important thing to remember here is that in terms of a modern frame of reference, people who had gone, for instance, you know, in the aftermath of the blasts at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they found vitrification there, and they say, you know, this is the only place in modern times we have seen this. And
exactly.
hence maybe we're dealing with a nuclear weapon. Whereas in modern times, again, we have not had a large-scale solar event capable of what you believe may have actually happened in ancient times.
This is absolutely correct, and this is because we have a very short time frame in terms of sort of a human sense of time, because, and this is something else I talk about in the book, so I can only touch on briefly here, I am convinced at this point that all the data indicates that the sun, our sun, is like any other typical star in its class. It goes through long-term cycles, and when I say long-term cycles, one of the cycles is on the order of about 10 to 12 to 15,000 years, where it becomes much more active at some periods, then it goes into a much quieter state, sort of a quiescent state, not exactly dormant, but, you know, still a star, it's still shining bright, but it becomes much less active in terms of spitting out things like major solar flares, coronal mass ejections. Then it basically builds up disequilibrium. It has to recalibrate and re-equalize itself. So on a crude periodicity of 10 to 15,000 years, it becomes very, very active again. Now, it was active, all the data indicates it was incredibly active at the end of the last ice age, 12,000 years ago, and many people don't realize this. Well, maybe they do now because it's been making a lot of news. In the last half century or so, the sun is starting to ramp up again. It's becoming very, very active again. So you're absolutely right that we haven't seen this in historic times. And when I say historical times, I'm talking the last 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. But it may be just around the corner, too.
Indeed, and that's kind of the general frame of reference for most people right now, is, though, the last few hundred years, whereas if we look further back, maybe there is precedent historically, or at least prehistorically.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing, and something, and I think I'm blessed in having been trained as a geologist. As a geologist, I learned very, very early, very quickly, that a few hundred years, even a few thousand years, is not representative of Earth time. You know, something that doesn't happen for 100 or 1,000 years. I hate to be trivial here, But I remember early on, you know, watching the national news when I was young. When I say when I was young, you know, in college.
Sure.
And the newscasters talking about a horrible devastation of, you know, all these houses were wiped out. I think it was the flooding of the Mississippi River or something. This hasn't happened for over 100 years. Well, yeah, but they built right in the 100-year floodplain. Things happen with a periodicity that's well beyond human lifespans.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And you know, in geological time spans, we're dealing with having to look much further back to find these answers. We have we have a question from the chat room. Caleb, my co-host, is going to ask this. Go ahead, Caleb.
Indeed. Greetings, Dr. Robert. The chat room would like to ask if you still think the Bosnian pyramid is natural and not evidence of an ancient culture.
Oh, yeah. We could talk about that for a very long time, but yes, it's absolutely natural. There's no question in my mind. I looked at it very, very thoroughly. I've been following the reports about it ever since, and I know a lot of people are disappointed, upset that I would say that, perhaps, but I have to call it the way it is. I mean, that's one of the things I've tried to stick with for all these decades now is, you know, the integrity. You have to call it the way it is, and I know Samir Osmanagic, known as Sam, colloquially, or he goes by the American name Sam. He's a very interesting, charismatic person, but he is, I'll be generous. I'll just say he's wrong in this case.
Absolutely.
I won't go into details about what I, you know, further. I mentioned it briefly in the book, but yeah, it's actually a very disappointing situation in my mind because some of my colleagues, academic colleagues. I'm an academic. I live in a university setting professionally, and they will look at something like the Bosnian pyramids that to any professional are clearly not artificial. You know, it's a natural set of hills, and it's a very interesting geologic situation why they're so regular, and I won't get into that now, but they're clearly not man-made except for what's being made in the late 20th and early 21st century. And they'll point to that and say, aha, you know, that's all been faked. And then they'll use that as an excuse to throw out everything else. So my point is I think it's doing a disservice to our community of, if I could call it, alternative thinkers.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phone lines now. Again, our practice here on the Graylian Report is to be able to call out an area code so you'll know we're addressing. You were going to go to 402 right now. Welcome to the program. What do you have on your mind for Dr. Schock?
Hello, this is Roger. I have something interesting to say about the sun. I'm a contactee, and these beings that I'm working with, they said some interesting things about our sun.
Uh-huh.
They said our scientists think our sun is a typical sun, a yellow-white dwarf, a yellow dwarf. And these beings said this isn't true. They said under the right conditions and circumstances, our sun can change DNA.
Uh-huh.
And they told me at this particular time that this is a make or break time for human civilization. So I thought I'd let you know that.
Yeah. No, that sounds very, very interesting. And I wonder if things like that, if that is correct, was, you know, I wonder if things like that were happening at the end of the last ice age too, because at that point, you get a lot of changes in flora, fauna. Some people would say, you know, even human changes or mentality at least. So that's very interesting.
Thank you for that call, by the way. You know, something else that intrigues me is we were talking a bit in the last hour before we had you on about the belief in extraterrestrial beings. Dr. Schock, in your experience, I know the ancient aliens is the famous thing. That's the big thing right now.
In your
opinion, how likely do you think it is that ancient aliens actually were visiting Earth? Or rather, to phrase that more appropriately, that alien beings from, you know, from outside planet Earth, extraterrestrials, how likely do you think it is that they may have visited Earth in ancient times?
Well, when you say likely, I immediately think you want me to put a probability on it, and maybe you do want me to put a probability on it.
Well, as a scientist, I'll put
and
it to
I'm
you like...
I'm not going to do that because I don't have enough data to do that. I'm basically neutral on the question right now. I'm willing to look at evidence. I'm willing to look at data. I'm not trying to evade the question. I've been on Ancient Aliens, this show, several of the series. I'm actually doing what's being called an Ancient Alien Cruise. I was invited to speak on Ancient Alien Cruise that some of you may know him. Hugh Newman, who does Megalithomania, and David Hatcher Childress and I are going to be speakers on a cruise in January, which was going to be a lot of fun, and we'll be discussing these issues at length, which is what it's going to take to really discuss them. But I tend to be neutral on it right now. I look at the data, but I am trained. I do have a bias, and we all have biases, and I think it's good when someone can admit their biases. My bias is not to invoke alien presence if it's not absolutely necessary, and I don't see it as absolutely necessary at this point, at least intelligent alien presence, versus outside external influences that have affected civilization. Things not unlike what the last caller suggested. If you think about the sun modulates the electromagnetic environment that we have here on Earth, that affects growth rates, it affects DNA, it affects a lot of things, affects psychological functioning of not just humans but other organisms. So there's a lot of influences that we haven't yet taken into account, or at least science, status quo science has not taken into account. And I think we need to look at all those, even as we consider the alien question also.
I have to also say, Dr. Schock, you know, as someone who is fairly familiar with your research and what you've done over the last several decades, you know, you are such a breath of fresh air because you're someone who is inherently skeptical, as every scientist should be, but you are open-minded. I try to be the same way. I don't put much stock, only because I haven't seen data or evidence that suggests, for instance, the ancient alien theory. And for there to be a PhD, tenured faculty member at Boston University on this program, who is without ruling out those theories, you know, you're open and accepting, but nonetheless, you look at what the data says and you still get into incredible subject matter. It is indeed so refreshing to be talking with you about this.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think you just summarized it nicely. I would not dismiss the possibility, but I think we also have to look at the data and see, you know, is there good reason to suggest such things? There's no question in my mind, for instance, that there is life out there other than on planet Earth, and there's intelligent life out there. I mean, the probability would say that's got to be.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. On that point, I certainly would. Now, you know, in some of your other titles, other books that you've written, you get into such things as, you know, for instance, in the subtitle of one of your books, The Parapsychology Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
This is one thing that you mention. And since I know that you do mention, at very least, Edgar Cayce, and having spoken at some of the events, I guess, that are put on by, I believe it was the Edgar Cayce Foundation.
Yeah, I've spoken to the Edgar Cayce Foundation more than once, the ARE, mm-hmm. Association for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach. And there was something to him. I'll put it that way.
Oh, really? In what way?
Well, if people know about Edgar Cayce, he was very, very good. He had a proven track record, for instance, in diagnosing illnesses. He was not trained as a physician, as a doctor, and he did this remotely, or, you know, using the term I would use, through parapsychological means. And he seemed to be able to, not seem to, he had a record of being able to diagnose illnesses and prescribe treatments for people that was incredibly successful, well beyond the bounds of, you know, just statistical coincidence.
As a scientist, how do you reconcile with that? How do you reconcile with the notion that someone may be doing what modern science tells us is impossible?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, modern science, when modern science starts saying something is absolutely impossible, and you have solid data, records, you know, objective records saying that, well, it occurred, and this was well beyond chance statistically, and if modern science, whatever modern science is, which really is the practitioners of modern science, say that's impossible and they won't look at it, they won't consider it, that's when science becomes dogma, and that is not a good thing.
We
have to avoid that.
I do see that so often these days. Dr. Schock, it's an incredible conversation we're having, and I hope you'll stay with us. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we'll pick this up and look a little bit more at perhaps what mysteries may be afforded us by speaking with intelligent enlightened and open minds when it pertains to the ancient world. I'm Micah Hanks, and we're probing the mysteries not only of the past and the present, but maybe of humanity's future. It is the Graylian Report, and I'm your host. We'll be back again right after this. Stay with us. In 2013, Mysteries of the Past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Speakers will include Scott Walter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at ParadigmSymposium.com. Mankind's Greatest Mysteries, brought to the present with new understanding. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report, and I am Micah Hanks. During this last segment, we will certainly open the phone lines. We've taken a couple already, but there are a couple of ways that you can reach us that we haven't put out to the audience yet, and so we'll do that now. To reach the program by phone, you can reach us at 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach us at Graylian Report. That's G-R-A-L-I-E-N, Report on Skype. You can email me directly, info@MicahHanks.com. And then, of course, text messages can be sent to the bunker at 828-367-7201. The phone line, again, is 828-398-4886. And finally, another way that you can always interact with us is in the live chat, which is available at GraylianReport.com. Just visit the podcast and radio page, and we'll try and get to some of those questions as they come. We're continuing our discussion with Dr. Robert Schock, who is the author of Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future, which, again, is just such a fascinating concept to me. And, you know, Dr. Schock, when we left off in the last segment, we had spoken very briefly about the possibility that this kind of thing could occur in the future. Now, of course, our purpose here is not to try and be fear-mongers, but I do think that there is perhaps even a certain importance to addressing the fact that if it happened in the past, this could indeed happen again in the future. Am I correct?
I think we have to face the reality. We have to face the data. And all the data says that this will happen again in the future. And it may not be in the far future. It may be in the near-term future. And I hate to say that, but that's what the data indicates to me. We had in 1859 something that was known as the Carrington Event, which was a coronal mass ejection and accompanying X-class, major X-class solar flare. And if something like that hit us today, it would just devastate modern society.
You know, that's, again, it's so disconcerting. But, again, I think it's something that we have to be aware of, especially in our survey of whether this could have been causal in the demise of ancient civilizations. And with so much theorizing and so much... Honestly, I think some of it gets into the realm of hubris when we talk about the potentials that in ancient times there may have been people who were affected by this. And we look at it today and people want to assert all these different kinds of ancient astronaut theories, or, you know, everything from nuclear weapons in ancient times to cosmic wars. You know, speaking of cosmic wars, as a matter of fact, I do also want to ask you, what is your take on the Mahabharata and some of the ancient Hindu epics? When they describe ancient wars and things like this, do you think that they're actually referencing, perhaps, an ancient civilization, warring factions, Atlantis, perhaps? Do you think that there are actual literal historical references being made there, or do you feel that what we're actually dealing with is quite the contrary, merely a mythology?
No, I've learned let me say it this way. I have come to believe over the years, as I've been studying these things, that when you dismiss things simply as mythology, you make a big mistake. You're throwing out data. Now you have to look at the mythologies, and sometimes you have to take into account that they've been passed down, that there have been changes made, that they've been reinterpreted. But what I've found in my own studies is that time and time again, what are simply dismissed as myths turn out to have a real factual basis. And I don't doubt in this case that there is some factual basis for that. And probably what we do have is major civilizations at a very early stage, which were, I believe, devastated by solar outbursts. And it's a question right now, in my mind, what level of technology had they achieved before, you know, they were devastated.
Do you feel that it was...
I don't know. And, you know, sometimes things in myths, you know, they get elaborated, so maybe they have a certain level of technology, and that has been elaborated as the myths were passed down. But even if you sort of notch it down a couple of orders of magnitude, certainly they were very sophisticated at that very remote time.
Absolutely. Do you feel, though, that we are potentially dealing with, you know, an advanced technology that existed in ancient times? And if so, to what level of advancement might this ancient civilization or civilizations...
No. That's a very, very good question, and it's very difficult to say at this point, because what do we have left from these early civilizations? We basically have a bunch of big stones that have survived and not much else. And I think it's telling that we do have a bunch of big stones surviving, because that's what would survive after these major cataclysms, these major solar outbursts. Associated with a major solar outburst, you would have major rains, you would have major protracted rains and flooding, that type of thing, because you would melt ice, you would vaporize water, you would put a lot of water into the atmosphere, and this would cause torrential rains and flooding, and that may be explaining what happened to the Sphinx at that very ancient time. It may explain the flood legends. You would also have incineration on the surface, as I mentioned before, probably wildfires, that type of thing. So a lot of things were lost that were not built in stone. So think about New York City. I think about things like this. New York City, if you totally destroyed New York City, incinerated much of it, what would you have left? Maybe some big, you know, fragments of concrete, that type of thing. And how easily could you reconstruct the technology that we know we have in New York City now?
That's a good question.
So it's very, very difficult thing to answer at this point. But that doesn't, in my opinion, mean we shouldn't stop trying. But I think, you know, I guess I don't like to speculate too much in the absence of data.
Certainly. Well, you know, and again, that's something that's not only necessary. I think it's also something that is highly respectable in your case, you know, or in the case of any person who calls himself a man of science. Let's go about this. Let's see what the facts dictate, but let's not leap into wild speculation. Unfortunately, in this field, there is so much wild speculation.
There is wild speculation, and if I could put it this way, there's wild speculation on both sides. There's wild speculation of people who say, oh, they were incredibly sophisticated, they had atomic bombs and all this type of stuff, and you know, more sophisticated technology than we have today. So let me put that in one class of wild speculation. Then there's the other wild speculation on the other side that I see among my academic colleagues, which is that they were so crude and so primitive. You know, they were nothing more than sort of advanced apes dragging their knuckles around. And frankly, that's wild speculation, too, if you understand what I'm saying, because, you know, there's no good evidence for that either, especially when you have, for instance, multi-ton blocks, blocks that are maybe 10 or 15 tons in the case of Göbekli Tepe at 10,000 BC. These were erected as stone pillars. They're beautifully carved, you know, incredibly smooth surfaces. How were they doing this? They had to have some kind of technology to do that. Or when you look at the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple, which was built simultaneously with the Sphinx, you have a temple that was built out of limestone blocks that weigh on the order of 10 to 50 tons or more. So that is not inconsiderable technology that must have gone behind building that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's such a fascinating conversation, and there's so much more that could be said. You know, I was telling my producers before we went to air that this is the kind of talk that I could have done for 2 hours, and unfortunately we're coming up on the end of 1 hour. So before we run completely out of time, I want to give you, Dr. Schock, an opportunity to tell folks where they can learn more about you, what events you're going to be at. I know, you, of course, we'll be having you in Minneapolis, St. Paul for the Paradigm Symposium this October, and I'm really excited about that. Can't wait to meet you and catch your lecture. But where else will you be, and where else can we learn more about what you do online?
Okay, well, actually, the first and most important thing is people can visit my website. It's www.robertschock, and I'll spell that RobertSchoch. So Robert Schock, all one word, and the last name is schoch.com. So www.robertschock.com. Go visit the website. You can get links to my books, especially Forgotten Civilization. And I will be speaking, as you said, at the Paradigm Symposium in October. The month before, in September, late September, and this is posted on my website, I will be speaking in Austin, Texas. So anyone that is in the Austin, Texas area, I hope that they will join me there. And it's I'm very excited about it because it will be a weekend with just myself. So solo event, so there'll be lots of time for chat and question and answer, and people really want to come and pick my brain. So I'm excited about that. And also, I heard during the break there was an advertisement for the Ancient Alien cruise that I will be participating in. That's in January. I'm excited about that. We'll be seeing some Mayan ruins. We'll have a lot of time to discuss all these issues while on the boat. That will be a lot of fun. And I haven't posted it yet, but something that I am planning also is I take people to various sites. I've taken groups to Egypt. I've taken groups to Easter Island, to Turkey, to Peru. And I'm planning right now, it's in the tentative stages, but I'm planning right now a trip to Petra, focused on Petra and some other areas in the Middle East for July. No, probably June, sometime during the summer. Let's say just sometime during the summer of 2014. So I'm excited about that, and that's not posted yet, but I will post it once it's ready on my website. In the meantime, if people want to go to my website and scroll down to the bottom, they will find actually the email for my wife. She handles these things. And if they'd like to be put on my mailing list or send me a note, and especially if they're interested in the summer trip to Petra and associate areas, just send her a little note, and as soon as we have that together, we'll send out advance notice to people.
Excellent. You know, that's what I need to do. I need to get a wife who will handle all my email correspondence for me.
She doesn't handle all of it, but she handles some of it, and I'm blessed for that.
Well, indeed. And we're blessed for having you here as a guest on the Graylian Report. I hope sincerely, Dr. Schock, that you'll join us again sometime on down the road.
It would be my pleasure.
And it will be indeed a pleasure to talk with you again then, as well as in October in Minneapolis.
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Well, excellent. Thank you again for joining us on the Graylian Report, and we will speak with you again soon.
Okay. Very welcome.
Thank you. That was Robert Schock. He is the author of the book, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. I have to just admit that, I'm such a, I can't call myself a believer, but I'm such a proponent of research into mysteries of the past that, again, mainstream science may not endorse these concepts, such as that there were civilizations that existed 10, 12,000 years ago, maybe, and things like that. You know, right here in the chat room, Red Pill Junkie just linked to an article. Well, maybe we'll put this with the show notes, and I'll ask Caleb to grab that link for us there. It's a link to a Daily Mail article that talks about the fact that in North American prehistoric times, humans could have been wiped out by a cosmic impact that killed the Clovis people. And, of course, this information may be reflected by what is known as ice core data. But the data has been found in a number of different places. Ice core data, of course, in coral reefs, but also in glacier deposits and in locations like this. So when you probe, essentially, parts of the Earth, whether it be ice or actual Earth, that were essentially unchanged, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago, scientists have found evidence of things which we cannot fully account for. And ice core data suggests at very least that there could have been something along the lines on the scale of a nuclear event that occurred that long ago right here in North America. That's always been fascinating to me. I won't leap to the conclusion that we're dealing with something akin to a nuclear weapon in ancient times, just as Dr. Shock said, but that maybe there are aspects to this mystery that conventional views in modern science have not yet taken an attempt to account for. And I think that at times we are so skeptical that we literally leave out some of the plausible possibilities. And I don't think it's impossible, maybe, that yes, there were people who existed before our time, and maybe that just someplace out there, at some point in history, there were people who existed who were far more advanced than many of us realize. I don't think it's too far beyond the realm of the possible. And if anything, these ancient civilizations may hold keys to understanding where our future goes. I worry about some of this EMP stuff. I worry indeed about some of the possibilities when it comes to electromagnetic pulse and mass coronal ejections. You know, NOAA and NASA have talked about the different possibilities and how in the very near future, just in the next few years, there could be some extremely violent solar activity. And I don't think it's fear-mongering to say that we should be aware of these possibilities and what they may entail in our future. And who knows, maybe by looking to our past, if you looked more carefully, we would find a few answers and we would perhaps even be able to prepare a little better for it. That wraps it up for this week. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of Caleb Tyler, Matthew Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, and yours truly, the Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu. We are the Graylian Report, and we keep you company every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, as well as Sunday evenings, same time, on KGRARadio.com with Micah Hanks' program. I am your host, Micah Hanks, and we'll leave it there for this week. Until next time, my friends, as always, stay strange, and we'll speak with you again very soon.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.